Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to another edition of Year in Review. Today we talk about the most interesting and relevant new data sets that have been presented over the past year in urothelial bladder cancer. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Shilpa Gupta from the Case Western Reserve University and the Hauseid Cancer Institute and the Cleveland Clinic in Cleveland, Ohio, and Dr. Tom Powles, the director of the Barts Cancer Institute, Queen Mary University of London in London, United Kingdom. But Tom is actually in Tokyo today attending a big meeting, but we're really happy to have him here from Tokyo. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by the faculty, just type them into the chat room and we'll talk about as many of these as we have time. We have a one-minute pre- and post-meeting survey posted in the chat room for you. If you take that, you'll get a lot more out of this webinar. We know a lot of people end up listening to our programs. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program with Dr. McKay reviewing some of the key presentations from the last ASCO meeting. We're continuing our year in review series next week when I'm focusing on another GU cancer, prostate cancer, with Drs. Armstrong and Hussein. And then on March the 5th, we'll be doing a year in review program on colorectal cancer. We're then heading out to the Society of Gynecologic Oncology meetings. We'll be doing two programs there for those of you who are attending that meeting, but also online we'll be showing this program March the 18th in the early morning on ovarian cancer, and then on that same day in the afternoon at 12:15 Eastern Time, or Pacific Time, 3:15 Eastern Time, on endometrial cancer. And there, of course, IOs, which we're going to be talking about a lot today, is also the hottest topic in endometrial cancer. In March, we're reawakening our weekend with general medical oncologists and the Florida cancer specialist joining us in our hometown of Miami. We have 35 investigators traveling attend this meeting, but again, all weekend long, we'll be putting these programs out virtually, and we are doing a urothelial bladder program as part of this with Drs. Galski and Rosenberg. Should be great. Hope you'll attend either live or virtually. We're starting up our Meet the Professor program again, focusing on myelofibrosis with Dr. Maso on April the 3rd. Today, we're going to talk about urothelial bladder cancer, and as we do in all of our year in review programs, I met with each of the faculty individually to record a presentation reviewing in detail a number of data sets that we're also going to refer to today. You'll get a lot out of this program by going in and checking out these presentations as well as what we're going to talk about here today. Dr. Gupta covered a bunch of papers related to localized non-metastatic disease, non-muscle invasive disease. We're going to talk about that in a second. And Dr. Powles focused on metastatic disease. So we're going to, before we get into each one of these papers, we're going to talk a little bit about where we were a year ago, and then a little bit about what happened this past year to change the way we approach these patients. But Tom, I want to start out with just a little bit of an overview. I saw this paper. I'm always looking for papers that, you know, have great insight into sort of translational issues in oncology, particularly immunotherapy. And this paper that you put out with your co-authors on the cancer immunity cycle, I thought was fascinating, completely over my head. I understood like 5% of it, has all these fantastic graphics that we could probably spend 2 hours just talking about these graphics. I'm just putting them in here to let the audience know they're there.
Neil, could you go back
one
for me?
Oh, yeah, okay.
That slide there, the new thing, it's actually very easy.
Okay. Okay, go for it. So I just wanted him to give us a little taste. A little taste. Go for it, Tom.
It's very easy. Before this new immune cycle, there was only the big circle here. There was no small circle. And what the big circle did is it essentially said that white cells, antigen-presenting cells, T cells and B cells, had to go through the lymph nodes for maturation. What we now know is it looks like T cell maturation can take place in the tumor itself. So we thought that all the troops had to be educated in barracks behind the scenes, but it now looks like we can train the troops in the tumor itself. And that's through a process of tertiary lymphoid structures, where it looks like the host, the human body, in these foreign tumors can create immune entities that have T cells and B cells and antigen-presenting cells. So the host reacts to the tumor and creates its own immunity. Now, it's slightly more complicated than that. But the point is, and that's what that small circle on the right-hand side is doing. So the small circle is basically saying the host can put active immune cells and can train T cells in the tumor itself.
Shilpa, any thoughts or questions?
No, I think this is really great, and congrats to Tom and team for putting this out, because with all these newer agents and we're learning more about how it interacts with the tumor and immune system. Great work.
So, Tom, you know, another issue is, you know, as we learn more and more, are we getting new therapies? Are we, you know, new targets, new checkpoints, et cetera? You know, it kind of seems like since the original checkpoint inhibitors, we've seen some, you know, secondary checkpoint inhibitors, et cetera. Where are we in terms of new strategies, Tom?
So, Neil, each of these boxes contains a number of theoretical targets which could work. So things like improving T-cell trafficking, improving T-cell maturation, changing the tumor microenvironment. But the reality is we've only had one group of drugs, despite multiple efforts, that's been successful. And that has been the PD-PDL1 inhibitors. Immune checkpoint inhibitors are actually loads of different drugs. There are 20 or 30 different groups of drugs. But it's the PD-PDL1 group of agents which has been successful in urothelial cancer. Essentially, all of the others at the moment have not been successful. And that ranges from T-cell stimulants into chemokines and cytokines. And other immune checkpoints have failed as well. And so it is unusual that we had this huge breakthrough, but we were unable to double down on that with a second generation of immune therapies. And we've not yet had that second generation of immune therapies. And in fact, there are not that many in randomized phase 3 trials right now.
So I guess we'll see where this leads in the future. I'm an eternal optimist that the second wave and third waves are coming. But of course, we have to get down to what we actually know at this point, and that's what we're going to do for the rest of the time. And a lot of this, of course, does relate to immunotherapy. So, Shilpa, you went through in great detail a number of really great papers. We're going to go through them, but I just want to take a breath and sort of tell you what I think our impression is from the general medical oncology community, which is really our primary target group in terms of continuing education. Sort of my take on your topic, which is non-metastatic urothelial bladder cancer a year ago, and in terms of what happens. And we'll get to this great slide you put together that you discussed in your talk. But, you know, my take, Shilpa, in terms of non-metastatic disease, at least from the point of view of the medical oncologist, was I'd be saying, wow, there's a lot of really cool intravesicular things going on, you know, TAR-200, all these other things. And that's more of the urologist play. Oncologists are seeing some patients for, you know, single agent IO therapy, but not too much from the medical oncology point of view changed this past year. A lot of new studies, a lot of excitement, but from our perspective, not sure I saw a big difference. In terms of muscle invasive disease, we still had the debate. We have more data now this year, but we still have the clinical debate about, you know, whether or not to use it and sort of how to use it. And we're going to talk about, you know, sort of some of the papers that came out that sort of modified at least the perception I just described. But globally, before we sort of get into this, what are your thoughts about, you know, sort of what are the major issues that oncologists need to know about in terms of non-metastatic disease, Shilpa?
I think non-metastatic disease, you know, medical oncologists have now become a part of the team that take care of the patients. And for patients not inclining towards radical cystectomy, they should certainly be referred to medical oncologists for a lot of trials and systemic immunotherapy options. I think the sad part is that the BCG, which is, you know, a very, very cheap drug, we see the shortages only in the U.S., not the rest of the world. You know, in the U.S., that's a unique problem. And for BCG unresponsive disease, there are a lot of newer therapies that have been approved. Systemically, it's only pembrolizumab. Nadofaragene is approved in the US, but still not available. And a lot of urologists are using intravesical gemdosi outside of a randomized trial. But there are options, and I think we need to make an effort to put patients on trials.
So, Tom, again, any comments in terms of, again, the community-based general medical oncologists are taking care of CLL, myeloma, breast cancer, trying to keep up with everything. You know, from the sort of 30,000-foot perspective, when you look at management of localized or non-metastatic disease, what are some of the key issues that oncologists need to know about and some of the key changes that have occurred?
So in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, nothing's really changed. You don't have to use pembrolizumab in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. You really don't. You know, there's cystectomy versus some patients may want it. And then in muscle invasive bladder cancer, it really is neoadjuvant chemotherapy, which is the same as it's always been. Gem-cis is fine. You don't have to give docetaxel MVAC. And then the adjuvant setting, the choice is, do you want to give adjuvant nivolumab? There's no survival signal yet. There's a DFS signal. And that's an area of active debate between people like Shilpa and myself. But the reality is some patients want to have it despite no survival benefit.
And, of course, the theme of patient involvement in critical decisions is something we talk about every day. Not every patient wants to be heavily involved, but many of them do. And this is a great example where that can be very helpful. Shilpa, I'd like to pull out some of the best slides that you guys put together. I love it when you come up with sort of summaries of some of the key issues. And maybe you can talk briefly about this slide that you used in your talk, kind of addressing what the unmet needs are right now.
Yeah, so the unmet needs are to develop effective regimens for BCG unresponsive disease. Like Tom said, you know, pembrolizumab is really a very, very modest activity, only 19% CR rates at a year. So we really don't have to offer it unless there's no other option for the patient and patient really cannot get cystectomy or doesn't want it. But for muscle invasive disease, I think we're still struggling with the underutilization of neoadjuvant chemotherapy, even though it's been a standard for many, many years. And 50% of patients cannot get neoadjuvant cisplatin-based chemo. 30% patients refuse it. And like Tom, I also believe that gemcis is totally fine. I rarely use docetaxel MVAC in neoadjuvant setting. And we also know that despite the you know, surgical expertise, radical cystectomy is a life-changing procedure, has significant long-term toxicities and quality of life impact, and we need to develop more treatment that can help our patients preserve their bladders without risking the risk of recurrence. And also on the adjuvant immunotherapy question, I totally agree with Tom. I really don't think that for adjuvant therapy with a benefit only in DFS, we need to offer it to everybody. In fact, in my opinion, we are kind of shortchanging them. When they become metastatic, we have such excellent therapies available. So I think unless patients really, really want it, we don't have to offer it. And there's only a subset of patients who actually benefit, those who've had neoadjuvant chemo, and upper tract is totally useless. So I think we are left with a very few patients who will actually benefit from it anyway.
So, Tom, it always catches my attention when I hear, you know, people talk about patients not getting what's considered standard of care. And we hear it every day, you know, and it's usually very complex to try to dissect out why. What are your thoughts? You mentioned that you thought neoadjuvant chemotherapy is underutilized. Do you feel that's the case internationally? And what do you think the reason is?
Yeah, it's certainly internationally less widely used than in the United States. You know, Neil, the issue is that that 3 or 4 cycles of neoadjuvant chemotherapy is associated with significant toxicity. And when you do this before a life-changing operation, many of the teams feel actually the patients was better off just having a safe, good operation. I don't think that's right. My personal feeling is the randomized trials show a modest benefit, only between 5 and 10% overall survival benefit, but it is a survival benefit for neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And many people say, well, for that 5 to 10% benefit, is it worth the risk associated with that neoadjuvant treatment? I think that's the wrong approach to it, because we remember in the randomized trials, we took the winners and the losers, those that got into trouble and those that benefited, and there was still a 10% survival benefit. But I can understand why many people say, let's do the operation and then consider chemotherapy afterwards. And you know what? That's what the Germans do. So the Germans like do cystectomy up front, and then the node-positive patients to get adjuvant chemotherapy, and the node-negative patients don't. It's become more complicated in Germany, because do you give adjuvant chemotherapy or do you give adjuvant nivolumab? And I think many of those patients are now getting adjuvant nivolumab and not chemotherapy, although it's only the chemotherapy associated with survival benefit.
So another issue I'm kind of curious about, and again, we'll take a look at the data, but I really think your talks are where people ought to go to get more details about that. But in terms of this issue of neoadjuvant therapy, Shilpa, I guess the issue could be, involving the patient and the decision and let them decide whether it's worth it to go through that. Maybe we can take a look at some of the data that we saw some updates this year. We were talking about the use of IO alone for non-muscle invasive disease. We saw, some more follow-up on that study. But we also saw, it looks like it's, maintaining. I don't know what, before we get to this, any thoughts, Shilpa, though, about Pembro nowadays? You think it's actually infiltrated out to the community setting? I think, usually I hear oncologists, maybe they've used one or two patients. What are your thoughts about this strategy, Shilpa? And how do you feel? I don't know if you've seen patients who theoretically or have their performance status to go to cystectomy, but don't want to.
Yeah, so I would say pembrolizumab really has been only modest activity, but I also only have a couple of patients on it, and those are the patients who are actively looking up options for bladder sparing when the urologist has offered a cystectomy, and they come to us. But routinely, we're not really getting referrals from urology because of the modest activity and, having a surgical option available. I think it is heavily underutilized in the U.S. I don't think it is approved elsewhere, right, Tom, for NMIBC?
No, we're waiting for randomized trials. We're not absolutely convinced by these data. We think there's activity, but it's hard to tell how much in a single-arm trial. And you can see there, Neil, you can see a lot of patients relapsing quite quickly. So it's clearly not helping everyone. It's probably helping about 1 in 8 patients in reality. I think it's interesting to have it in your armory. In the US, you tend to approve things quite quickly and let doctors decide. In Europe, we tend to be more robust, perhaps, and authorities decide more. And this hasn't been approved yet.
So, Shilpa, you also presented some new data looking at durvalumab. What was the message that came out of this? It was interesting. Here, this is BCG refractory, but they used durva plus BCG.
Yeah, this was an interesting study, very, very novel, because we usually don't use radiation with in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. So this is a very early study, phase one, where they use full-dose durvalumab with or without BCG, and with or without radiation. So the 12-month complete response rates were higher with the durvalumab and BCG cohort. In fact, they were the highest. By itself, it was only 46% for all comers, and not so impressive with the radiation. So in my opinion, this is still very, very early data, and we need to see phase two, phase three studies. And we do have several phase three studies with the IO BCG combinations.
So, Tom, there are a couple of comments in the chat room. I think the chat room syncs up with me mentally after a while. We kind of think along similar lines. As I say something, they're typing the same thing. So, Venue, as I was asking you this, type this so you can respond, Tom. 40-year-old patient, muscle invasive bladder cancer, does not want cystectomy at any cost. I got three opinions. Decided to do chemo radiation now with non-muscle invasive bladder 2 months after chemo radiation. Still doesn't want cystectomy. What options do we have for this young patient, Tom?
So the first thing is, in Europe, we probably give more radiation therapy than in the US. So chemo rad is an option. I don't think I personally don't think the data is robust, but I don't, you know, the UK doesn't seem chemo rad as being inferior to cystectomy. I know in the US and in parts of Europe, cystectomy is the standard of care. So I think that's a very reasonable treatment. I think a patient not wanting a cystectomy at this point, I think it's pretty risky, honestly, because they're running into an environment now where things are probably going to go wrong and metastatic disease is pretty lethal. So I would be saying to them pretty strongly, if you don't have that cystectomy, it's probably going to become metastatic quite soon. If they're still saying, I'm not having cystectomy under those circumstances, there are things like giving, this is, by the way, this is way off-piste and not licensed. But you might say, what about giving, you know, the equivalent of adjuvant nivolumab under those circumstances? And therefore giving a single agent immune checkpoint inhibitor just to see what happens. It's my personal feeling, and this isn't driven by, well, it's driven by adjuvant nivolumab. It's probably true that immune therapy works a bit better earlier rather than later in the disease. And so I'd be saying to this patient, look, adjuvant nivolumab is associated with a disease-free survival benefit after surgery. It's probably the same in a radiation situation. Why don't we have a go here? But Neil, that's a long way off piste.
No, I mean, it's also really helpful. I mean, one of those common comments we have is that our audience likes it when they see that you don't know the right answer, because they think we're not alone. You know, here's this doc's and trying to figure out what to do with this patient, and maybe there's not a perfect answer. Another comment in the chat room before we get into some new stuff that's really exciting from Demetrius. Do you recognize there's a growing number of patients that are being enrolled in that are getting neoadjuvant therapy, who expect afterwards to preserve their bladder, which, you know, you think about breast cancer, that's what they do. You know, you shrink the tumor down, so you change the surgery. Is there any way to satisfy this trend with the current armamentarium? Shilpa, do you see the potential in the future of pre-op systemic therapy that'll facilitate a lesser surgery?
I think that is our ultimate goal, and, you know, we're not there yet, but there's been some trials done by Dr. Galsky, for example, who used Gemcis, nivolumab, and then for patients having a clinical complete response, patients could undergo forego cystectomy. The issue is, you know, we need more biomarkers to accurately select patients, so I would think that in the future, use of imaging along with ctDNA and cystoscopy evaluations will really help us understand with confidence what are the risk factors, and doing more biomarker work will help us select these patients with more confidence. But right now, as Tom said, after neoadjuvant chemotherapy, standard of care is to do surgery, or in the UK and Canada, they do chemo radiation after that. And again, we are looking at that in trials right now.
Neil, could I just interrupt? I'm in Tokyo now. And the reason I'm in Tokyo is I'm giving a talk on this exact issue. And I think within a 5 to 10 year time frame, we will be doing cystectomy in the minority of these patients. I think we'll be curing them with systemic therapy, with combinations of antibody drug conjugates, immune checkpoint inhibitors, but also this intravesical device we're about to talk about right now, this Pretzel device, TAR-200. I think the triplet of immune therapy, ADCs, and TAR-200 might actually cure a lot of early bladder cancer.
So TAR-200 is super cool. We've heard about it for a while. I really thought it was fascinating the first time I heard about this Pretzel. And now they're combining with a checkpoint inhibitor, sotrilimab, which I think is not approved at this point. But in any event, that'll be, Tom, as you were saying, fascinating. Anything, Shilpa, you reviewed it. I really recommend people check that out. Anything we also are seeing now, I guess this is the TAR-210, putting erdafitinib in the pretzel that goes into the bladder, which is super fascinating. I want to get your take on that. This is a study that Shilpa talked about, Tom, the THOR-2 cohort 1, So this is oral erdafitinib versus intravesicular therapy. And the thing that's really fascinating about it that I wanted to show you, this is another paper she talked about. This is the 210 paper. This is what I wanted to show you that I thought was so fascinating. So this is the plasma and urine concentration. This is of erdafitinib when it's put into the pretzel. And the thing that's interesting that I was like looking at going, wow, that is super cool, that you can see that the serum concentration is much less. And I guess you don't see anywhere near the amount of issues, hyperphosphatemia, et cetera. So, Tom, I was going to ask you this in terms of basic physiology. I sort of made up this term based on the blood-brain barrier. And I don't know if I missed this day in med school or not, but is there a blood bladder barrier that, like, that for example, is preventing the erdafitinib to get out?
Yeah, so if you did miss this day in medical school, I missed it too. I'll tell you something quite – look, we've been doing a little bit of work on this issue. And in non-muscle and muscle-invasive bladder cancer – your circulating tumor DNA, you can measure circulating, you can find cancer DNA in the blood in at least half of the patients, perhaps more. And so there is no barrier here. This is a systemic disease. And the reason why we give neoadjuvant chemotherapy and immune therapy, and you know, why on earth would intravenous pembrolizumab work in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer if there was a big barrier there? And the answer is because it's a big systemic disease.
That's not what I'm not talking about the disease. And Shilpa, I think you know, maybe you can elaborate on this. I'm talking about the pharmacology here. The fact that when you put it into the bladder, you get a very high concentration, but it doesn't go, it's the erdafitinib that's not going out of the bladder into the systemic circulation, which kind of makes perfect sense because you have toxins in the bladder. You don't. So I assume the urothelium protects egress out of the bladder. Anyway, maybe it's just an academic point. We can move on. But Shilpa, any thoughts?
Yeah, I just think it's the what you're saying, that most of it is concentrated within the bladder and does not cause the systemic toxicity, makes sense, because none of the other intravesical agents, you know, cause systemic toxicity except for like BCG, which also causes mainly urinary toxicity.
Neil, I think she was right. I'd like to agree with her. I think she's got it right.
Yeah, I may be just pointing out the obvious, but maybe that's my job. Anyhow, she also is talking about the use of EV Pembro in the neoadjuvant situation or in the non-metastatic situation as well as in the muscle invasive situation. But Shilpa, maybe you can sort of, this is very clinically important and we alluded to it before, adjuvant IO and the disparity in the three major trials. Can you kind of summarize that and kind of what, from your point of view, the clinical implications are of these mixed data?
So yes, of course. So there are three phase three trials that have now reported, INVIGA010, led by Dr. Powles here, which randomized patients to atezo versus observation. It was negative for both disease-free survival and overall survival, and that data was presented many years ago now. The second trial is CheckMate 274, which randomized patients to nivolumab versus placebo. Primary endpoint was disease-free survival, which was met. It was more pronounced in PD-L1 positive patients. But as we saw that the benefit was only in patients who actually got neoadjuvant cisplatin, we have still not seen any overall survival data. I have heard some rumors that we may probably see something this year. And more recently, we saw another PD-1 inhibitor, pembrolizumab versus observation in the Ambassador study, which showed disease-free survival improvement, but there's no overall survival improvement on that analysis. Unlikely that it will become positive. So the big question is, you know, even if we think about PD-L1 versus PD-1 story, in the nivolumab, we have still not seen overall survival improvement despite the study being done many years ago. So I think to me, this is, you know, not an ideal adjuvant therapy should show an improvement in overall survival. if we did not have any effective therapies in frontline setting, then of course we should definitely use a lot of nivolumab, but we do, and that makes me take a pause. And secondly, I think with also Tom's work from IMvigor010 has now set the stage for ctDNA-guided patient selection who benefit most from immunotherapy. So that work is in the IMvigor011 study that is going on and the modern study.
Yeah, that's the thing I think a lot of people are interested in, Tom. And this comes up almost any time we do a program on a solid tumor, people are asking about ctDNA. Can you talk a little bit about what you looked at in terms of ctDNA in the IMvigor study and whether, you know, right now, colon cancer, they're using ctDNA, you know, to make adjuvant decisions. Do you see that coming in the future for bladder cancer?
The selection of patients who have had a successful operation and need no further therapy, which is about 50% of people, is one of the most important issues we have in this disease. Because at the moment, we are over-treating patients, about half the patients, with drugs which have life-changing toxicity. And this is true for adjuvant therapy, not just in bladder cancer, but in other tumors as well. The attractive component of urothelial cancer, which is different from some of the other cancers we treat, is it does look, by doing a blood test, we can identify circulating tumor DNA, and we can identify mutations in the blood from the cancer, and we can do this reliably. And those patients who have ctDNA, they have about a 95% relapse rate, and those patients who do not have ctDNA only have about a 15 to 20% relapse rate. There's going to be more data at the EAU in Paris in about a month's time, and updated data on this showing what happens if you're ctDNA negative and you remain negative. What are the chances of relapsing? And I can tell you, if you're negative, it looks like the chance of relapse is really low. And that will allow us to select out those patients that we don't need to put in harm's way with these adjuvant therapies, which I think is really important.
So, yeah, I'm looking forward to that day. I think it really could change the outcomes here. So Shilpa also talked about the use of enfortumab in the neoadjuvant setting, and I want to just show you a couple of things from that as we head towards what I think is the most important topic we have today to talk about, where there has been a huge, gigantic shift in the past year, first-line therapy and metastatic disease. But I just wanted to go through this neoadjuvant trial to point out the fact that they actually had a death, or 51 patients, from Stevens-Johnson syndrome. Because one of the issues, I think, as we move, and here's some more data from TAR-200, incidentally, in metastatic and muscle-invasive disease that Shilpa reviewed, and some other papers on organ-sparing therapy that we've talked about. But clearly, as we look back over this past year, the biggest change in this field in general has been the use of enfortumab vedotin plus pembro in the first-line metastatic setting. And we'll talk about the data and also other data that Tom reviewed, updates from the JAVELIN study looking at avelumab maintenance, a new study that came out looking at nivolumab plus GemCis. Follow-up data in terms of pembrolizumab. But I guess maybe, Tom, can you kind of begin by kind of putting in perspective the other issue here, which is enfortumab and pembrolizumab. Can you kind of talk about your global view of what's happened over the last 2 years? To me, it's been really a stunning story. Can you kind of talk about what we've seen and where we landed, like, right now?
So I think it's fair to say that both immune checkpoint inhibition with maintenance of avelumab and the antibody drug conjugate enfortumab vedotin, which targets Nectin-4 and has MMAE as a payload, those two drugs were being routinely used in patients whose cancer, in patients who previously had chemotherapy. And one was a maintenance therapy, one was a second-line therapy. But over a period of 40 years, we were never able to beat frontline chemotherapy despite multiple attempts, and that's GemCis or GemCarbo. And what we did most recently is we combined those two drugs together in fortunamabodotin and pembrolizumab. And much of this work, some of the phase two work out of the US, and Jonathan Rosenberg and others led that work, they showed response rates of 70% to the combination. That was much higher than we expected. And so essentially we did a big randomized trial. And in that study, we showed the combination of EV Pembro was associated with a 55% reduction in risk of progression and a 53% reduction in risk of death. We showed 70% response rates, 30% CR rates. We showed an interesting adverse event profile, which would be good to talk about. But essentially, it means that when we look at this disease moving forward, our patients will want to have EV Pembro, not platinum-based chemotherapy and maintenance nivolumab. And it also means that, you know, things like the median survival now seems closer to 3 years than it does to 1 year when we started this trial. And so the transformation, I think, is really large. And I think the next generation of oncologists won't be talking about platinum-based chemotherapy. They'll be talking about EV Pembro. And I think that's already started. I know it's approved in the US. It's going to be approved in the rest of the world very soon. And again, we're talking about it here today in Japan. I can tell you the Japanese are very excited about it as well. And one of the key issues is about education and training to make sure when we use this for the first or second time, we give the drug safely. It's not more difficult than platinum-based. It's not more difficult than platinum-based chemotherapy. Actually, the adverse event profile, there are fewer grade 3 or 4 adverse events. For example, there's very little hematological toxicity, but there is skin rash, there is peripheral neuropathy, and there are other adverse events that we should talk about.
So, Shilpa, here are some of the slides that you reviewed in your talk. I'm just going to sort of flip through them. You know, again, really want to focus on the conversation here today. We can go back and look at the slides later, but of course, the benefit here is really very, very striking, as Tom just described, both progression-free survival as well as overall survival. As Tom mentioned, an incredible hazard rate of 0.47. You know, it's interesting, historically, I think I'm correct in saying, Shilpa, there was a time that this was only approved for people who were not platinum eligible, correct?
This combination got approved for platinum eligible patients, actually, because in the study, only patients who are platinum eligible could go on. And if we look at the inclusion criteria, even those with ECOG performance status 2 had to be very robust. You know, they had to have a hemoglobin above a certain. So I would say that for someone who's truly platinum ineligible, meaning they're so frail that they can't even get carboplatin, I would be a little hesitant to use EV Pembro in those patients. I don't know what Tom thinks, but patients have to be able to be reasonably fit unless they were very fit, and then because of the disease, their performance status became really bad.
So, yeah, Tom, what about the frail elderly patient? Are you able to give this regimen?
Well, the first thing is I'm keen that we stop using the platinum eligible criteria to choose patients for EV Pembro. It would seem perverse to use criteria for one regime to choose giving a different regime. So I think we need to start talking about which patients are eligible for EV and Pembro. Clearly, patients who have a performance status of 3 who are really struggling, for some of those patients, even this regime is too late. There aren't attractive alternatives, and Shilpa's right. I wouldn't be offering them GemCarbo. I think if you're fit enough for GemCarbo, you're fit enough for EV Pembro. And then I guess the other issue is which other patients can't have EV Pembro? And maybe those patients with active autoimmune disease on immune suppressive therapies, they can't have the Pembro. And then maybe patients, you know, with really bad existing skin rashes, for example, who you'd want to be cautious with infortumabodotin. But I agree with Shilpa, almost all the patients who are eligible for platinum-based chemotherapy are also eligible for EV Pembro. And in fact, my experience of the combination is it's really good at getting control of disease. So those patients who are coming in whose performance status is not great with bad cancer-related symptoms who are otherwise relatively well, I would give EV Pembro a go to try and get in control of disease.
Yeah, what I was saying was that, as Shilpa was saying, you know, in December we saw the approval for all patients, but prior to that, I believe there was an approval for platinum ineligible. And at that point, I was thinking to myself, I think that's what I want, whether or not I'm platinum eligible or not, just as you just said. So we went through about 8 or 9 months in that scenario.
For cisplatin ineligible.
Cisplatinum, right.
Yeah, right.
Right. So I think I want to also go back in a second and talk about some of the other data, the update from the Javelin, as well as the new Nevo study. But my number one objective here was to spend just a couple of minutes, and we could spend a lot of time on this. And again, I refer you to the two talks. We talk a lot more in terms of prevention and management of toxicity with EV Pembro, because this is here. And, you know, obviously it's critical that people know, you know, everything they can the first time you use it. So, Shilpa, these are the numbers, but what I want to know more is more the granularity of what you see, particularly the skin issues, the dermatologic issues, and the neuropathy, more about exactly what you see and what you do.
Yeah.
Shilpa, so, you can start.
Yeah. So, you know, even though there's more myelosuppression with chemo, you know, we can prevent that with growth factors. We really can't prevent peripheral neuropathy or rash. So, and we have to see that almost 50% patients will get neuropathy at some point, can get very disabling. It can be peripheral sensory neuropathy or motor neuropathy. So it's very important to just do a great physical exam, ask patient questions. Are they dropping objects? Are they is it affecting their gait and make them walk? Because it's very easy to, prevent that from worsening, and it will get better if we hold the doses. And patients will still keep responding, in my experience. I've really had a patient where I had to hold the drug and then they progressed. Same for rash. The moment we see a rash, it is really nothing to push for the EV. We have to hold it. And if it doesn't get better, we have to attribute it to pembrolizumab, start steroids, refer to dermatology, and all the things we usually do. But I think the big approach is that these are unique side effects, which a lot of oncologists have not seen before, and there's a need for awareness. Also, this can lead to catastrophic diabetes in patients who are not baseline diabetics. So it is important to monitor the blood glucose levels every time and pay attention to these things. We'd love to hear if Tom has anything additional.
Tom?
I agree with you, Neil. I think it's the most important issue in urothelial cancer right now is to make sure that the training and education around giving these combination is robust. My experience of the combination is that it is no more difficult to give than platinum-based chemotherapy. In fact, it's probably a little bit easier, but it is different. I mean, remember, cisplatin probably wouldn't be approved today. It's associated with kidney failure, where we have to give IV fluid to prevent that. It's associated with terrible nausea. We have to develop drugs like ondansetron to prevent that nausea. It's associated with neutropenic sepsis. So the platinum-based chemotherapies are very difficult to give, and we've learned how to give those. EV Pembro is not as challenging as that, but it does have its challenges. The skin rash in the first three cycles is really important. If you do get a skin rash, don't treat through the rash, because it can get worse and worse, and that's really important. And the second thing is the peripheral neuropathy, it's cumulative and is both sensory and peripheral and motor. And so it's not the normal peripheral neuropathy that you see with pins and needles in the feet. It can cause instability in the gait as well if you treat too much. And that only comes after a number of cycles of therapy. And so essentially, when you're watching that peripheral neuropathy, you shouldn't be treating through that on cycle 8, 9, and 10. You should be giving treatment breaks. And I can tell you, we've had a number of patients who had early peripheral neuropathy, grade 1, early grade 2. You shouldn't be treating through grade 2 toxicity. That's quite bad, because that's going to go to grade 3 and grade 4. If you pause at early grade 2, at late grade 1, you give patients time off therapy, you dose reduce, you won't get neuropathy. And we've found that this is reversible if you intervene early.
So I want to go on in a second and talk about erdafitinib, but just to get back to this issue, we mentioned the fact that the Javelin data really, and the Javelin approach of maintenance IO has been the standard for a while. We saw some updated data from that. But we also saw this new study come out, Checkmate 901, adding Nevo both to the chemo and as maintenance. Can you kind of summarize what they saw there? I don't know if this at this point is more historic interest, because indirectly when you compare to EV Pembro, but I am curious what your thoughts are about this. It looks like they saw a pretty decent benefit from the strategy. I guess it's not clear whether how much adding it to the chemo is part of that, but what's your thoughts about the study, Shilpa?
So this was a combination study of nivolumab and GemCis versus GemCis alone. And we saw that it met its primary endpoint of overall survival. But if you look at the numeric difference, it's just 2 months, two plus some months. And we don't want to do cross-trial comparison, but we really can't not do it here with EV-302, where the curves separate out early, stay like that here. Just like Tom and I and you were discussing earlier, we think it's probably from the maintenance nivolumab part that they are really deriving benefit. So I would really have to think hard about which patient I can't give EV Pembro and to give this instead. Because if, let's say, somebody has bad peripheral neuropathy, then I really can't give cisplatin either. So I don't know why I would not use EV Pembro and rather use this. And also, it's not even approved right now. So I want to point that out for the audience.
So, at Tom, we see the response rate was increased, the PFS was increased. Hassan in the chat room wants to know, why did nivolumab with chemo win when the others failed? But, and I, again, I don't know if this is more of historic interest, but probably if there wasn't EV-302, we'd be spending the whole hour talking about this and Javelin. Tom, any comments?
Yeah. That was a wonderful question. I didn't hear who it was from. Was it Nizar or?
Hassan.
What a great question. Look, I'm going to give you a one-second summary of my opinion about why that's the case. If you look at, there have been three trials, chemotherapy plus pembrolizumab, chemotherapy plus atezolizumab, chemotherapy plus nivolumab. The results of all three show similar trends. So the trends are all showing hazard ratios in the late 0.7s and early 0.8s as a rule. And some of them are statistically significant. But actually, because the benefits are relatively marginal, and I think most of the benefit is driven by that maintenance period, I think we're showing actually that all three have more similarities than differences. The one difference with nivolumab is they selected the cisplatin-only population. And that cisplatin-only population is probably about 10% better with immune therapy. Not 50% better, it's probably about 10% better. And so that combination, most of the benefits being driven by the maintenance phase, but that cisplatin combination is giving just that little bit of boost for a positive trial, where the atezolizumab study and the pembrolizumab trial were negative.
So if you're a GU fellow and want to see all the details, check out the presentation and all the data that is discussed in detail. But let's talk a little bit about erdafitinib. You know, certainly an interesting, exciting agent. We just talked about it using amazingly and intravesicularly, but of course, obviously, systemically in metastatic settings where we've seen it. Can you talk a little bit, Shilpa, about this agent, your clinical experience with it? And in particular, it just seems like everything ends up having an IO added to it. And now we're starting to see data on erdafitinib plus an IO sotrelimab that I mentioned before. So can you maybe comment a little bit about this agent, Shilpa, your experience with it clinically and what we learned about it this year?
Yeah, so this is an FGFR3 inhibitor, one of the earlier agents. And in the phase 3 TOR trial, it improved overall survival compared to dealer's choice chemotherapy like paclitaxel or vinflunine in Europe. Hazard ratio was 0.58. In reality, I only have just a couple of patients on it because, you know, FGFR positivity is really around 10% in the real world. But my experience with this agent is that it's hugely toxic. You know, we spend so much time on the phone with the patients and, you know, one might think, oh, it's a pill, just give it to the patient and then see them in a few months. It's really not the case. It is actually the most toxic agent out of all the agents that I give, in my opinion. You know, patients' nails start peeling off. They have painful nails, and there's eye toxicity. So really, you worry about retinopathy in this. So I always worry whenever I prescribe it, and we have to be really on top of things, check their labs weekly for the hyperphosphatemia. So I would say it's a great option. We've also learned from the ESMO that it does not need to be given before immunotherapy, even in FGFR select patients. So I would always use immunotherapy first and then use this. It's certainly a very reasonable option. We just need to make sure the dose is titrated down and not up, and monitor patients closely. Hopefully we'll have better FGFR inhibitors in future.
So let's get a second opinion. That was pretty strong wording there, Shilpa. Tom, do you feel that strongly? Are you able to keep people in erdafitinib comfortably?
Shilpa and I agree on lots of things. In fact, we agree on almost everything today. I think it's as difficult as any other drug. I'm not sure it's, in my experience, the most difficult. But she's right. The nails and the mouth is sore. The duration of response is not as long as we would like. Don't get me wrong, as a single agent, it's active with response rates of 40%. And remember, chemotherapy in heavily pretreated patients is only 10%. It doesn't seem to combine synergistically or particularly additively with immune checkpoint inhibition. So I think it's going to end up being a single agent monotherapy in FGFR altered heavily pretreated patients. It's not going to be the front line or the neoadjuvant transformative drug. But in the non-muscle invasive and muscle invasive space, where we saw TAR-210, FGFR, and the Pretzel, that doesn't have that systemic toxicity which you talked about. And that's going to be associated, I think, with potentially transformative results. So I'm going to be speculative, if I may, and say this is the first chapter of a two-chapter book. And the second chapter is we give this earlier in the disease, intravesically, and cure bladder cancer patients with it.
I love it. And actually, I think, isn't it true that you see much higher incidence of FGFR in non-muscle invasive?
Yes, sir.
So
yes,
you're just going right to the core. Get the cancer at the core. I like it.
Yes, you are.
So, but getting back to today's reality, Shilpa, this kind of reminds me of the day Atezo-Bev came into HCC. Like all of a sudden, all the data that we had to get thrown out because we never had that as first-line therapy. I kind of think like we're about to do that now. We spent the last few years, going through all the sequences, what comes first, erdafitinib, sacituzumab, and fortimab. And now everything just got blown up because first-line therapy is going to be EV-Pembro, I think. So, okay. Shilpa, first question is, we're talking about FGFR. What's your second-line therapy in a patient who gets first-line EV-Pembro who's got an FGFR alteration?
In that patient, I would use erdafitinib for sure if they have FGFR alteration. I'm not saying we should not use the drug. We just have to be very, very cautious and proactive with the toxicity management and prevention. So for a patient who has progression, I think platinums will also play a role, even though we don't have data in that space. We've always used platinums in frontline setting. Now we'll have to start thinking of trials starting to use. We have used for patients, for example, who went on the EV-302 study and progressed on EV-Pembro, I did use platinums with good responses if they didn't have bad neuropathy from EV-Pembro. So I think the field we'll have to just learn as we go as to what is going to be the best option for the patient.
So Tom, again, second line therapy in a patient is getting EV-Pembro, first line FGFR positive or wild type?
So it's a bit of a data-free zone. In EV-302, the vast majority of patients received subsequent chemotherapy, platinum-based chemotherapy. And the ESMO Guidelines Committee, which I'm lucky to be part of, has met, and we're going to publish it very soon, we hope. It's going to come out in the next month or so. We think platinum-based chemotherapy is the standard of care after that. We had a debate about FGFR inhibition with erdafitinib in those patients with FGFR alterations. I think the majority of the committee still felt that FGFR inhibition hasn't beaten platinum-based chemotherapy yet. It's beaten single-agent chemotherapy, but not platinum-based chemotherapy. And so the majority of the committee didn't feel the data was as strong for FGFR or erdafitinib, even in FGFR-altered tumors, than chemotherapy. But it is there, but it hasn't got as strong a kind of a recommendation. So, and I think other ADCs like sacituzumab, govitecan, I think we have to wait for trials for positive randomized data to really get a good feel for how active that drug really is. And therefore, post-EV Pembro, platinum-based chemotherapy is the standard of care. FGFR inhibition for those patients with alterations. And then other approaches at the moment are speculative.
Now, Tom, let me ask you a question on that, if Neil, you don't mind. So, you know, there's also no data for sacituzumab in the second line post-EV Pembro. We still haven't seen the data with sacituzumab post-platinum and IO. So I wonder where its utility will be in the changing landscape. And yeah, it will be available, but I would certainly prefer a platinum over sacituzumab if I had to use in second line.
I think as it currently stands, you're absolutely right, Shilpa. We only have 100 patients with sacituzumab govitecan. None of them are post-EV Pembro. And so until we generate or see more data for that sequence, I think we should be going with platinum-based chemotherapy. 70% of patients, that's what patients on EV Pembro got, and EV Pembro had great results. So let's stick close to the trial. I think we'll see sequencing ADC data in the not-too-distant future. And if it does appear that the TROPiCS-4 trial is very positive, that the sequencing data is great, and we generate more data, then SG could supersede platinum-based chemotherapy. But I completely agree at the moment, SG would be a third-line agent, not a second-line agent for me.
I just wonder about tolerability of SG versus platinum chemotherapy. I think SG is pretty well-tolerated from what I'm hearing, but you know, obviously, where there's no data, we have to try to figure out what's best for an individual patient. I just want to finish out with a couple words. I feel like almost every solid tumor program we do nowadays at least mention HER2-directed therapies, which, of course, started out with breast cancer, then quickly, in terms of at least antibody-drug conjugates and TDXD, moved to lung cancer, gastroesophageal, probably coming to colon cancer, biliary tract cancer, and urothelial bladder cancer. I used to brag about you guys in a couple years ago because you had two antibody drug conjugates approved metastatic disease. No other cancer had that. Now you got two HER2 ADCs, and they both cause responses. I don't even know which one's going to be used first or what's going to happen. But bottom line, Shilpa, it looks like pretty good activity with these two antibody-drug conjugates. Of course, TDXD, we're seeing that over and over, and as I mentioned, a variety of cancer. But the tisotumab vedotin, another antibody-drug conjugate, now to HER2, seems like it has similar efficacy. Any thoughts? And what about tolerability, Shilpa?
I think, yeah, it does show promising activity. I know I have not had experience with this agent myself, but the lung toxicity is quite significant, if I'm not wrong, and we have to just be cautious of that. But otherwise, this is pretty impressive data, and so is the one from the pan-tumor destiny study.
Yep. Tom, any thoughts? I think in terms of ILD, so, I think it's mainly TDXD. And, of course, here is the data. You see some of the other, but in the middle there is bladder. You see, you know, response rates, 56% with a pure IHC positive. Tisotumab, I think it was 60%. So both of them over 50% response rate. Tom, any thoughts, any issues in terms of tolerabilities? What do you see happening in this space? Do you think we're going to land first line someday?
We've used this drug in phase two studies. We haven't seen lung toxicity. We've seen some of the adverse events outlined in this slide here. We've seen some fatigue and perhaps some neuropathy. But we haven't seen as much skin rash, and that was true also from this data published in JCO. I think it's a very active drug in those patients, particularly those patients who overexpress HER2, and that's about 60%, because it's only HER2 1 or 2 or 3 plus, and it's not HER2 by FISH. So the majority of patients in our experience are HER2 positive, and we're seeing response rates above 50%. EV was only 40%. So maybe, you know, we've got a new fabulous drug here And we just need to look after it carefully, develop it correctly. And I hope we're going to have a plethora of options. Again, targeting Nectin-4 is one approach, but HER2 does seem like a really attractive, a complementary approach.
We actually did a CME program on bladder cancer at the GU symposium, and I showed video of a breast cancer investigator to the GU investigators in terms of their experience using these anti-HER2 antibody drug conjugates, how they screen, side effects and toxicity. The general medical oncologist didn't know about this for the last few years, but when it comes to a specialty like you guys, you're kind of starting from scratch. Anyhow, thank you so much today. It was really great to hear all this exciting information, Shilpa and Tom. Audience, thank you for attending. If you think this is exciting, come on back next week. I want to tell you about the EMBARK study and now management of patients in the M0 setting, the impact of radio-labeled PSMA on all of this. What a fabulous story there as well. Be safe, stay well, and have a great day. Thanks so much, Shilpa. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Neil.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Shilpa. Bye-bye.